Last week I did a splash and dash, a real quick introduction to a pivotal character in church history. When one history book I have, and it has a chapter on Augustine, and it says, the mind of the church for over 1,000 years. The mind of the church for over 1,000 years, meaning that he was the go-to guy. You know, he taught rhetoric and grammar and in universities, and then became a Christian, and so he was quite the writer, communicator, and a tremendous mind, and because of that, everyone looked to him for how they understand the faith. Now, we understand in our journey through church history that a lot of the faith was hammered out in conflict. There would someone come up with an idea, and then we would wrestle back and forth with that idea, trying to decide whether it was appropriate or inappropriate. So Augustine comes around; his life comes around the time of the fall of Rome. Rome fell about 410 and had been a city without anyone penetrating its borders for over 600 years. All the way back 200 BC, Rome was established as a power. Rome was the controlling power over Israel in the 200s and BC. So for 650 years, the city had stood, and it was thus called the Eternal City that Rome would always be. And, you know, it's kind of like America. We only got 250 years under our belt, and we feel like we're the Eternal City, the Eternal Nation. Nothing will ever penetrate our borders and that sort of thing. Right prior to Augustine was Constantine, who was the Roman emperor. And in 315, he legalized Christianity, and in 325, he called for the council at Nicaea to try to get Christianity together and unified, which was a big task. And it, the issue there was with a man named Arius, who, if you take the well-known John 3:16, for God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten son. Well, if he's a begotten son, then he was begat. And if he was begat, there was a time when he wasn't begat. And so it was a time when he was not. And he did not want to attribute deity to Christ because it would interfere with what major theological premise? Trinity. The Trinity. You'd have to introduce Trinity. Monotheism was the champion of Judaism, and monotheism is the champion still of Christianity, and monotheism is the champion of what we will talk about next week. We'll begin to start looking at Islam, as Islam will build upon the Old Testament. It will build even upon Jesus, and saying it will recognize Jesus as a prophet. And so they're not anti-Jesus. They're just saying that Jesus was a prophet. He wasn't deity. He wasn't, you know, the Word becoming flesh and wasn't God. And so at the Council of Nicaea, Arius had said Jesus wasn't deity. And, so they wrestled through that at that particular council. Well, Augustine, as I said, comes on the scene at the end of an era of 300 years of intermittent persecution. So since Jesus all the way up to the time of Augustine, there was persecution. Sometimes it would be continuous for 10 or 12 years, and then it might be 40 years elapsed and no persecution. So that's how that worked through there. Now, the church had all of a sudden now reached legal status, which they hadn't had in three centuries, and everybody was supposed to rejoice, but a lot of people didn't. Why?
It could be contaminated with the world.
It's going to be contaminated with the world, that the church is becoming partners with the state. And And so a lot of people left the church in a movement we call monasticism. They went out into the desert, says we were not going to be contaminated by the culture and the world. Now, Augustine lived in North Africa. Okay, and his father was a pagan, his mother was a Christian. They made sure he got a stellar education, when he was in his teenage years, his mission in life was get as much pleasure as he could get. And so that's what he chased after. He had a mistress when he was 17. By 18, she'd given him a son. And they'll live together for about 13 years. He'll have at least an association with her for that period of time. Christianity is going to go from the persecuted to now we're free. And as we get into the 500s, 600s in that era, then the church is going to become the power of the empire rather than the emperor. We'll follow that. For 9 years, Augustine followed what is called Manichaeism, and this was a blend of Gnosticism, Zoroastrianism, Hinduism, and Buddhism. And he followed that for 9 years. And then he said, well, I won't go into the details of that because it really doesn't matter. He runs into a man by the name of Ambrose, A-M-B-R-O-S-E, who was a Christian. And he was drawing such crowds that Augustine thought that he ought to go and listen to him, not in terms of what he was talking about, but how he talked. Because that's what, if you teach rhetoric, that's what you're doing. You're teaching people how to talk, how to present an argument, how to, you know, speak and those kind of things. So he went to him to listen to him because he was a great speaker. But as he listened to him, and in order to understand his ability to draw a crowd in and hold a crowd and communicate, wanted to learn how he communicated, he began to be influenced by his teaching. We have that famous statement that he was in desperation about his life. He was no longer satisfied with the Manichaeism that he was following, and he was tormented by the fact of his own sinfulness. Let me read just an excerpt out of this book here about his life. Now, I want to take the time tonight to give you a little bit better grasp of Augustine, because it is no small statement to say that he was the mind of the church for over 1,000 years. When it came to making decisions about the faith, when it came to questions about issues, this was the guy they went to. Even up until the time of the Reformation, Martin Luther. Well, see, you go from 400 up to 1400s when the Reformation occurs. The Reformation people, they were quoting Augustine. And so he becomes the mind of the church and having an influence similar to the Apostle Paul. Now, the Apostle Paul is we call him the interpreter of Christ. When he's writing in his letters, he's trying to help people understand you don't have to be a Jew to be a Christian. It's not by the keeping of the law that you're saved, but by faith. The sacrifices in the temple are completed. We now have Jesus, who is the atoning sacrifice. Now, did the church understand that from the get-go? No, they didn't understand it from the get-go. They were still attending temple when Jesus ascended and went back to the Father. They were still attending the synagogue. They had not put that all together. So Paul, it helps, you know, get us going in the right direction. The Judaizers were the group of people who said, yes, Jesus is fine, but you got to still be a good Jew. And by the keeping the law, you're saved. And Paul wrestles through that. So Paul becomes the mind of the church in that first, you know, shaping 2 or 3 centuries, okay? But Augustine from 400 on, he shapes the church. And so you really need to have understanding of who this guy is that shapes everybody. Now, the thing that happens, though, is that people on two sides of an argument, both of them will find sentences and paragraphs from Augustine to quote. And they'll say, oh, he's an Arminian. Oh, he's a Calvinist. Oh, he's a, you know, on we go. But he was, Augustine was really, a man who was striving to try and get it together, although he spends most of his life not getting it together. You know, living, in what we would say living in sin and that sort of thing. He wrote, he said, I can never find real happiness because I sought it in things that were less than God. Okay? And that's one of his famous, statements, but, he said, I made myself the center of my desires and I willfully turned away from light. And he said at one point he was stricken with his own sinfulness because he and a bunch of guys went out and stole some pears. And he said, why did I steal them? I did not like the company of the boys I was with. The pears were green and I was not hungry, so I tossed the pears to some pigs. I was not moved by the excitement of stealing them, so why in the world did I steal them? And he begins to think through this process and said, well, sin lodges in my inner being. And it will find expression. He says, when a man sins, be it theft, sexual satisfaction, murder, whatever, he's proclaiming himself to be God. And he's fulfills things that will satisfy himself. Now, God is totally free to do whatever he wants to do, right? And so it's a powerful insight to say that's sin. That's what sin is. I want the will, the right. I want to be able to do whatever I will to do. And I don't want anybody telling me it's wrong. And if I do that, then I'm becoming as God. I do whatever I want to do. God answers to no one. And so we'll have concepts that come out of Augustine that are like original sin. And how much of a sinner are you? And how will grace shape in your life? And that sort of thing. They're there. And we need to look to those. Okay. Now, so he went to Ambrose, who was a bishop in Rome, and just to listen to him talk. Because he figured he could learn something about speech making. And he wound up being converted by his words. And he goes back to North Africa after that. En route to North Africa, his mother dies. And the son that he had by the illegitimate wife, well, she never was his wife, but the mistress, that son dies. He had previously left that woman and was engaged to a wealthy woman because he figured, you know, I might as well, if I'm going to marry, I might as well get, you know, some money out of the deal. But so anyhow, he goes back to North Africa, and he's so torn by all these losses and his newfound Christianity that he winds up establishing a monastery, and we know what a monastery is, where the monks gather, and he established one in North Africa. And in North Africa, there was a movement that had been around for about 100 years. And it was a movement called the Donatists. And they were upset with the churches of the day who married themselves to the culture, got in partnership with the state, and that during persecution, especially during the Diocletian, the Emperor Diocletian, one of the last persecutions that happened before Christianity was legalized, there were several of the bishops or the priests or whatever who gave the scriptures over to be burned whenever they came through during the persecution. And some of them renounced their faith and all that sort of thing. So a group of people started, once the persecution lifted, these people came back and said, okay, we're ready to take over again. And the Donatist says, you know, you're not a Christian. and you gave up the treasures of the church. And the bishop who ordained you as a priest, he turned out to be a traitor. So you don't have any credentials. And so they turned away from the organized, we'd say the Catholic Church, and said, we're the true church. We're the pure church. We did not give up the faith during the persecution. And so now you've got in North Africa, you've got the Donatists who are saying they're the true church. And you got the regular, all the other, you got the bishop in Egypt, you got the bishop in Antioch, you got the bishop in Rome, all of those, and they're divided. Once again, we're split. At Nicaea, the church was split over the doctrine of the deity of Christ. Now the Donatists were saying, we're the pure church. We're the true church. And if the guy who gives you baptism turns out to be a heretic, turns out to renounce the faith, then what happens to your baptism?
Jinxed.
What?
It's jinxed.
It's jinxed. It's no good. You're not even getting communion and that sort of thing. And so now when Augustine takes these people on to try to bring them back into the fold, Augustine's mission was the unity of the church. It was so important to him that when he could not talk them back into the faith, what did he authorize?
Force.
And he said, for the sake of unity, we'll do it. He said, and he used an analogy. He said, a shepherd, the thing we was having Saturday, one of the people was asking me, how do you control all these cows? How do you get them to go where they're supposed to go and do what they're supposed to do? Well, I said, most of them know I'm the shepherd. And when I feed them, I call and they come and they know they get food from me. And so they do a pretty good job of listening to me. The young ones, the teenagers, that's where Gail and the dog come in. You got to move them with Gail and the dog. I call the mamas and they'll follow me and the little calves will be all curious, wondering where everybody's going. But they won't move unless the dog and Gail bring up the rear, okay, kind of thing. Well, I lost where I was going with that, the dog.
Why it was so important to bring him back in.
Okay. Now, he was saying that a good shepherd would try lovingly to move the sheep. But if one doesn't come, what's he going to do? He's gonna take that crook, the other end of that walking stick, and he's gonna hook it around their neck and jerk them. Or he said, fear is fine. We'll run if we can. Only way you can get them back in the fold is to make them afraid, and that's fine. And now, but the problem with that was that once that was a step, like I said, now if he's the go-to guy, and he says force is okay, he even quoted Jesus saying that when the people didn't show up for the banquet, what should you do? Compel them to come in. Compel sounds like, don't give them an option, right? And if you have to snatch and grab them and drag them in. Now, compel, really there was more in the line, not forced action, but in beg and plead, implore them to come would be the word to use there. But compel, he took that word and said, okay, Jesus said compel, so we'll compel them. Now, And at first, it was an appeal to the state to bring the military down. And they fought with the Donatists for 5 years. And finally, just went home and said, we can't make them come back and come back to Christianity because come back to Catholicism. And so they left them alone and thought it was okay, but then it built back up again. Now, here, let me get that thing. Now, whenever you say, the administrant of the Lord's table is false, does it make this false? Or if the administrant is false and he does this, does it make this invalid? You know, I'm from a Southern Baptist tradition, and years ago, you know, 50 years ago, they had a thing that we call alien baptism. You know what that means? It doesn't mean that somebody they got baptized on Mars or by a Martian. It means that you got baptized with somebody outside the
Baptist,
which is I got baptized outside the Donatists. You know, the Baptists say we're the true church, and so therefore, if you receive alien baptism, you can't be a member of the flock unless you are baptized by a Baptist. Now, I married a heathen. She was a Methodist. Even though she hadn't been just sprinkled, she had submitted to baptism. But as my wife and I'm the pastor, she can't be a member of the church unless she is rebaptized. And she has to say, is my baptism invalid? You know, is it invalid? Because I, you know, and so at any point, what I'm saying to you is the issues that developed around Augustine are real. They continue to be, and people will quote him as the answer to whatever. Now, and what happened was, and he started talking about the Lord's table, he said it's God's sacrament, and this guy is the channel of God's sacrament. He doesn't make it God's sacrament, but he's the channel through which the sacrament flows. Now, that sounds okay, and it doesn't sound like it'd get us into trouble, but later the church is going to say, only this guy can give this. I mean, in other words, if you're going to get the Lord's table, and they taught that the Lord's table was to cover post-baptismal sins and all that other sort of thing. And so if the priest decides not to give it to you, can you pray over the elements and make it become the Lord's table? No. Only an authorized priest can pray over the elements, and they now become the body and blood of Christ, which cleanses us from our sins. Now, see, all of this is a precursor to what's going to happen in the 600s, 700s, 800s, 900s, into 1,000, and on up to 1,400s. It's going to be the foundation. And here's where the thought pattern is first being established. And so you need to appreciate what's being talked about here. Now, okay. Is there such a thing as a pure church? The Donatist says we are the pure church. Catholicism is full of a bunch of people who recanted during hard times and now come back. And the Donatists, if you lapsed during persecution, meaning you took the easy road, and then you decide, I repent and come back, would they receive you back? No. It counted like apostasy. You know, Hebrews says there is no forgiveness for that sin that you, but I'm not going to get all the way into that, but the importance of unity in the church, Augustine said, that's not a small thing. And would you agree? How unified is Protestantism today? I mean, they're not even unified within their own rank, much less across the board, okay? But we don't have the Baptists picking up a sword and coming after the Presbyterians. Oh, they might like to, but they don't. I mean, you know, but you see, there's so much gets established here that you really have to appreciate how he becomes, his thoughts become influential throughout the church. Now, he said it's better to lead people back to the fold with love. But if the only way you can get them there is with force and fear, it's for their own good. So it was okay. But now, I don't know that Augustine would have said, you can kill them. But certainly, that's what becomes the fulfillment of that. Okay. Now, the Donatists he ran into. And a lot of things come out of that argument with the Donatists and trying to get them back into the fold. Another thing that was on the... There was a man by the name of Pelagius. Pelagianism was an issue that he faced. Let me tell you something about Pelagius who came on the scene. Okay. What did Pelagius teach to arouse Augustine's vigorous opposition? This monk denied that human sin is inherited from Adam. Man, he said, is free to act righteously or sinfully. Moreover, death is not a consequence of Adam's disobedience. Adam indeed introduced sin into the world, but only by his corrupting example. There's no direct connection between his sin and the moral condition of mankind. Almost all the human race have sinned, but it is possible not to sin. And some people have, in fact, lived without sin. God predestinates no one, except in the sense that he foresees who will believe and who will reject his gracious influence. His forgiveness will come to all who exercise faith alone. But once forgiven, man has power of himself to live pleasing to God. Thus, Pelagius found no real need for the special enabling power of the Holy Spirit. Now, does Pelagius say some things you like and some things that you dislike, some things you agree with, some things you disagree with? Okay. Now, this movement, this issue that he came upon, touched hard on Augustine. Because Augustine wanted to do right, and what did he wind up doing? What kind of life did he live? He couldn't do right if he tried. You know, he welcomed the grace of God. He said it was only the grace of God that changed me.
So Augustine, this you know, the sexual sins and all that, was that something he just struggled with his whole life?
Yes.
So he didn't convert to Christianity and that kind of waned away. It was just a lifelong struggle.
It was because, you know, he went from a life of hedonistic pleasure, do anything and everything I want to do, and he said... He disdained marriage because he said it was just an endless cycle of sexual involvement, but then once his mother and his son died, he went to North Africa and he became a monk. So he had to embrace a celibate lifestyle, and so he'll do a lot of writing about marriage and that sort of thing. And okay. Now, but this guy Pelagius comes along, and you know, it's like we mentioned Marcion. You remember Marcion, who said that the Old Testament God and the New Testament God are what? They're different, not the same. And so they had to fight against him. Tertullian was one of the guys who fought against him. Well, you've got Pelagius who comes on the scene. You got Arius who comes on the scene that says Jesus was a time when he was not attacking the deity of Christ. Now, when you think, oh, how could he do such a thing? Well, he would rather deal with, he didn't say Jesus was just a man, but he said he wasn't God. He was a what? A third kind. Not man, God, but a third kind. Okay, now, but he didn't want to disrupt his monotheism, which he felt like was extremely important. Okay. Just like Augustine said, unity is important enough. If we have to drive them back in, we'll drive them back in. Okay. Now, and whenever he talked about forcing people to come back in, he said, what did Elijah do on Mark? You remember the Old Testament? What did Elijah do on Mount Carmel, the Baal prophets? Contest of the fire, see whose God is real. fire, call down fire from heaven? After the contest, what did they do? Killed them all. So don't tell me we can't use force. That sort of thing. Okay. Now, okay. Pelagius. Now, there's several names that you're going to, you need to know. Okay. Pelagius is, talks about this. Free will. He talks about it so strongly that man, he says man is so free that he can actually do what? He can live without sin. And he said, in fact, there are people who live without sin even before Jesus. Right or wrong? Why?
How do you prove that? It'll be a mind reader.
Well, but scripture says, but, no man is without sin. Go to Paul's writings to Romans. No man is without sin. And we've all sinned and come short of the glory of God. Isaiah, you know, on it goes. Okay. And there's none of us, righteous. No, not one. On it goes with those things. The scriptures are pretty strong there. But now, what happens is in wrestling with this against him, Augustine sets the stage for what we would what happens at the Reformation, principally led by Luther, but the teaching part was led by Calvin. And Calvinism comes against this right here. Why do I say that? That's the difference between believing that you exercise your free will to become a Christian or God saves the ones he's predetermined to be saved. It's the total choice of God. That's the only way it can truly be grace and not what? Not works. Now here, Augustine is not the first person in the history of the church to champion predestination, election, that sort of thing. He just says it in a powerful way. And later, he becomes the one that they reach for in terms of, you know, when the Reformation happens, it really is wrestling with a work salvation, right? As he will talk about faith alone, and they will talk about grace alone. Those are the things that we're saved by, not by works of keeping the law or by penance or any of those other kinds of things. But here's where the foundation of all this teaching goes. Now, at the time Calvin teaches on as opposed to a work salvation, it's all the total act, the total choice of God, the total grace of God. It's got nothing to do with works. There was a man who came along by the name of Arminius. And he said, you know, if God does all the choosing and only people are saved is who God chooses to save, and there is what is called irresistible, what do we mean by irresistible grace? Grace is going to come on you and you're going to respond because God's bigger than you are. Right? Okay. And the emphasis here is trying to say it's not any of this stuff. God does it all. Okay. Arminius said, wait a minute. I'm not ready to go after, you know, I know what Augustine was wrestling with, Pelagius. You know, to say you've got a free will, I don't believe that free will is strong enough to keep you from sinning. But I don't believe God condemns some people to hell just because they don't make the holy lottery. You understand that concept? I don't know where, you know, the holy lottery is what? Your number's either going to come up or it doesn't. And God chooses who's saved based on what?
His choice,
his will, nothing you've done, good or bad. Does my son get an extra help on the lottery because his mom and dad happen to be Christians? No, it doesn't. Okay, and so, you know, as I said, my roots are Southern Baptist, and it's historically Southern Baptists have been both Arminius and Calvinistic. They've got that both of those in their roots. Right now, the seminary that I attended, which was Southern Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky, the president there now is trying to reinsert Calvinism as the major dominant doctrine of the church now, as opposed to people who believe that salvation is a choice you make and that God meets you in that. Now, we're going to talk about this more when we get there at the Reformation. And as I told you last week, the pendulum swings back and forth. And it's, you know, one guy stepped upon the scene and we have the free will that if we would choose right, we would not even sin. And God slams the door over here. You don't have any free will. It's all the work of God, not the work of you. And you don't have to, you know, and so, you know, when these folks start wrestling with people differently, they try to say, well, you're being Pelagian. And I'm not, you know, we're not willing to go that far to say that I believe that, you know, people make a choice and God doesn't condemn some people to hell, by just choice numbers that come up. Is, you know, and I, my personal, my, this is, no, okay, personal, got that word? My personal position on this, although I have some strong theological, biblical supports to what I believe, but my personal wrestling with this, if you, you know, with the, is everything predestined by God? Is everything, God controls it and shapes it, or do I respond? You know, do I believe? And I look at all that. I have to look at it and think. Okay. All right. When this life is passed and I stand before God, okay. Well, let me do this right here. Okay. I stand before God. I've got 8 grandkids. Okay? And when I stand before God, they are either in or out because they hit the holy lottery. Under Calvinism, okay? I'm not trying to be unkind when I use the word holy lottery, but it's a number that comes, I mean, it is, God chooses not on the basis that they are good people or bad people. God chooses not on the basis of anything they've ever done. In fact, before they're ever born, it's chosen whether, when they come into life, whether they're going to be able to be among the elect or among the damned. Now, when I stand before God, and if that's the concept, I'm supposed to look at God and say, well, I look around. I'm hoping that I've hit the lottery, but myself, but you know, but the point being is I look around me and only 2 of my grandkids are with me. And I'm supposed to stand in the face of God and say, I'm good with that. Would you be good with that? If I stand before God and only 2 of my grandkids are with me and I know it's because their refusal to receive God's grace, I can be good with that. I'm not satisfied and happy with that, but I can at least say, okay, they had every opportunity. I know that according to Romans, that God visits every person. And they either accept God's visit or they reject God's visit. They either respond to God's initiative or they don't. I know no one can be saved unless God takes the initiative. Right? So it does begin with God. But there must be a response. Well, all of this is being will be hammered on for 1,000 years. And even today, as we live right now, I mean, a church my brother pastored just recently, a new pastor has come on the scene who is not Arminian but is Calvinist, and the church is going through a major struggle right now because my brother taught, you know, you've got freedom to make a choice here, respond to faith, the grace gift of God, and now the new guy's coming in and saying, hey, it's predetermined by God. And so the church is going through a real struggle because right now in that denomination, there is an attempt to go back to something that happened a long time ago. Okay. So these issues are not history. These issues are real. These issues are, you know, part of the fabric of the church now. The only difference now is when people come up with crazy thoughts and ideas, there's no way to deal with them. I mean, we don't have church councils. We can't declare people to be heretics. I mean, people are allowed to do anything and everything they want to do. Okay? Now, okay. Let me get at a couple of things here. So what this guy had to say was crazy. Although he had some, you know, when you read through here, you know, he says that we're saved by faith alone. And I agree with him. Yes, we are. But to deny the empowerment of the Holy Spirit that we might live a righteous life, then I have to say you're wrong. And, you know, a guy can be right in some place and wrong in another is indicative of where all we all are in terms of our faith. Okay. Now, but Pelagius, you need to know who he is. You need to know who Augustine is and how he responds to these people. Now, like I said, in fact, I'll give you a handout. Okay. Let me give you a handout. Tim, if you'll do this one here. There's a fellow by the name of I think there's two there. Y'all got this? Okay.
How many pages are there?
Two.
Okay, I already got that.
Okay. Now, I hope that you'll take this with you and you'll read. And what I'm trying to do with this particular handout is to give you a little bit more exposure to some of the thoughts of Augustine and how it has this great influence in the church. The place of reason in your faith. You see that under the headline Augustine, Bishop of Hippo, 354 to 430. He has spiritual pilgrimage from paganism through Manichaeism, on then to Christian theism. Like all great thinkers, he struggled to understand the relationship between faith and reason. Many apologists tend to stress Augustine's emphasis on faith, underplay his affirmation of reason. And you go on down, it says, they stress passages in which the Bishop of Hippo placed faith before reason, such as, quote, I believe in order that I may understand. I believe that in order I may understand. Indeed, Augustine said, first believe, then understand. For we wish to know and then believe, we should not be able to either know or believe. However, these passages taken alone leave the wrong impression of his teaching on the role of reason and faith. He also held there is a sense in which no reason comes before faith. I'm on the second page now, page 44. No one indeed believes anything unless he first thought that it is to be believed. Hence, it's necessary that everything which he believes should be believed after thought has led the way. Now, and it's an interesting paragraph. He proclaimed the superiority of reason when he wrote, God forbid that he should hate in us, that God should hate in us the very thing which makes us superior to all other beings, meaning the ability to reason. Therefore, we must refuse so to believe as not to receive or seek reason for our belief, since we could not believe at all if we did not have rational souls. Now, you'll go on and read this just some comments that he makes. And what I want you to do, it takes time. You've got to read it more than once. You read it, and then you kind of go back and read it again. And then you read the third time, you underline some of these statements. But what I want you to realize that it's not an understatement to say that Augustine was the mind of the church for 1,000 years. They reached for his thought patterns, and you need to know how that influences the Christianity of today. Now, okay, I'll return to him several times. We will touch his teaching several times. I want to demonstrate something to you real quickly. I've got 5 minutes. Okay. There it is. Okay. All right. We have a thing called the Bible, right? Did one person write it? No. Okay. We got this thing over here. We got this thing over here. Okay? The first 5 books of the Bible, we call them the what? Why do we call them the Pentateuch? 5 writings. Okay? Penta and Tuch is writing. Okay? Written by Moses. Okay? About how many years before Christ? 1225, okay? All right. We have a man by the name of David. Did he make a contribution to this book? To the book. And he wrote around 1,000. What would he say he wrote? Psalms. Did he not write Samuel? Kings? No, he didn't. They're written by editors. Okay? If you go to this guy here, he was about 750 BC. You go to this guy, and there's a bunch of prophets in between, Isaiah and Jeremiah. Jeremiah, he wrote around this time. After, that's when they took him off into captivity. And then there's a guy by the name of Malachi. He wrote around about this time. How many zeros did I get? 3? 400. Okay. So from here to here, how many years have elapsed in the formation of the Old Testament? Round numbers. 800 years. Okay. We get on this side. We've got Mark written in the 60s. Revelation and John written about, let's be conservative, 90 to 100. Okay? So how many years elapsed in the formation of the New Testament? 40 years, doesn't it? How do you account for the fact that they're still receiving books for 800 years here? And we only received books for 40 years here.
Canon was closed by...
Okay, when was the Old Testament closed? 90 AD. Okay, that was 60 years after Jesus. They still said the Old Testament canon was open. Why did they close it in 90? What happened in 70? The temple was destroyed, the nation was destroyed, and how long has Israel been without being a nation? When did they reform? 47, 48, somewhere right in there.
There's also a theory that they didn't want some of the current books floating into the canon because, well, they have good reasons, but some of them had the word Jesus in them, and they didn't want to go there.
Right. Okay. Now, how come from 400 down to Jesus, during this period of time, 800 years, nothing happens, books still open, but from 400 years down to Jesus, how come they didn't add any books?
No prophets,
they said.
God wasn't speaking?
They said, but who's deciding God's not speaking?
Yeah, that would be my question. In 90 AD, who made that decision?
Okay, the temple was destroyed. And so the hierarchy of the high priesthood and the priests and all that stuff, it all gets dispersed. The people, you know, run to the hills to hide and that sort of thing. But then as the heat lifted on Judaism, which it takes 60 years, you know, after Jesus and 10 years after the destruction of the temple for the priests to get together and say, we got to close this thing. Because like Danny said, you know, they've got all these Christians, the Christians who are still keeping all of these books. They pick this thing up and go and just are adding to it. And the Jews are saying, no, you can't add. See, we take all of this and all of this and we say that's our Bible. And they come in and stop and said, well, wait a minute. There's no more books. Okay. Now, okay, so my point being is this. If Augustine is the mind of the church, why didn't he get a chance to write a book? You know, we accepted books for 800 years over here, and we only accept books for 40 years over here.
Writing in the wrong language.
Okay.
All
right, now. All right, whenever you're riding along here, okay. So the point I want to make with this, and I want to get back to what you were saying here. The point being is, if the Bible hadn't been closed, you have guys like these coming along. And boy, we'd have a whole bunch of stuff to be working through. You know, but the point being is that, okay, from 33, getting an official book of New Testament books. How many books in the New Testament? 27. How many in the Old? Because 3 times 9 is 27. Okay, that's an easy way to remember that. Okay, now, during this time, the church is persecuted, right? And so, what can the church do official? You don't have a structure to do it, you know, and you know, you walk out and say, hey, I want to declare to all Christians in all regions what books to take and which to not. Because, you know, we have the Gospel of Thomas, and Thomas was, probably had the most definitive statement to say about Jesus than anybody made. What did he say at the resurrection of Jesus? After he touched him? I won't believe until I touch him. And then when Jesus comes in, he says, my Lord and my God. I mean, it's a tremendous statement. Okay. We have the Gospel of Thomas. We have the Gospel of Mark, Gospel of Matthew, the Gospel of John. We have the Gospel of Peter. And all the way through here. Okay. We didn't have any church structure then because it's illegal. And you couldn't identify yourself as a Christian. And there's a lot of struggle goes on during that time. But had the book, and so the final decisions were reined in to, we're only going to take a book that is either written by an apostle or the associate of an apostle, has the oversight of the apostle. Mark, supposedly, Mark was not a disciple. Mark had traveled with Paul on his missionary journeys. He didn't get in because of Paul. He got in because of Peter. He was working with Peter in Rome. Luke gets in. He's not a disciple, but he's a companion of Paul. The rest, so they had to have some way of reining all this in, because you got Marcion, you got all these people writing, you got Pelagius, you got all these people coming on the scene, and the church had to close things off. Did they make a good decision?
I think they did.
Would still be writing.
Barnabas was in there.
Yeah. They'd still be writing, and everybody taking a vote, just like right now. Denominations are taking a vote on how to interpret Roman's statement about homosexuality being abhorrent to God. Okay? I mean, it's true. I mean, you know, we're all going to say what. So, I was getting my teeth worked on this weekend. I'd taken my one of my history books to read, and she asked me what I was reading, and I said reading church history. I said, for most people, it's like going to see the dentist. You know, got to do it, have to do it, but don't want to do it. You know, kind of thing. But I said, you know, unless you got to realize we're living this. There's no. I believe in my lifetime of nearly 70 years, there's no important time than this that we have to recapture the true meaning of Christianity, or my grandkids are not going to know what it really means to be a Christian. Because we cannot, because of where we live, one faction of Christianity can't rise up and eliminate the other. If you got somebody that's saying something you don't like, you can kill them when you were in power. We got a harder road to hold, because anybody can call himself Christian. I mean, I don't know about any about these, but there's a new storefront church opening up every day. And I wonder, what's it founded on? What's it going to be promoting? And, this particular person I was talking to said, well, you know, the church needs to change, because that way more people get saved. And I said, well, now, they need to change in order to get saved. We need to make sure we know who's doing the changing. And but there are people, you know, my poor brother, he's 2 years older than me. He's been pastoring a church there in East Tennessee. And they still believe it's their calling from God to impoverish the pastor. I mean, you'd think he was head of a monastery and take a vow of poverty. You know, he doesn't make minimum wage. Daggum, he works 60 to 80 hours a week, and at $6 an hour, they wouldn't be paying him for the time he makes. And he goes back to them and says, I've been here 7 years. I haven't got a cost of living raise in 7 years. Could I possibly get a cost of living raise? They gave him 1.5% raise. You know what I would have done with that? You know, the problem being is, you know, I'm sorry. I'll get up on a horse.
I got another one for you, too. You were talking about Augustine and unity. And one of the things I remember about Augustine was that he said that, the purpose of tolerance is to prevent a larger evil. And Augustine, if he was going after unity, he has the same problem that we've got today. And that is, you know, what are we going to tolerate But we are now in a period where people don't look at truth as an absolute anymore. You know, you can have your truth, and your truth is as good as anybody else's truth. So you can't really do calculations on what's really good or evil, because it's just evil to you or evil to somebody else. This lack of absolutes has practically killed his whole thesis on how to get to this point of unity through tolerance.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of problems churches face, and among them, and it's time to go, but, you know, I've lived in the world where I couldn't paint the daggum bathroom without having a church vote. And that's about as silly and stupid as anything that I could ever imagine. And you wind up in the situation I was in years ago, that the people with the least amount of spiritual maturity were making the decisions for the church. And, you know. What? Yeah. Yeah. So, at any rate, these issues are part of us, and we've inherited a lot of it. So we'll go, and we'll continue to pick back up.